Kasem Shepard is in studio with us. He's the author of City Makers, The Culture and Craft of Practical Urbanism. Thanks so much for coming in and being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So what is practical urbanism?
So practical urbanism is a way of thinking about a wider range of how we're making cities and transforming communities that goes beyond the traditional ways we talk about city making in terms of elected officials or power brokers or the people sort of at the top.
Mm-hmm.
But it also tries to not exclusively talk about just the people at the bottom and the bottom up either, but to really try and get beyond the binary of top down versus bottom up to talk
yeah.
about all the people in between who are dedicating their lives either through their professions or as volunteers to making their neighborhoods just a little bit better, a little bit more sustainable, a little bit more equitable, a little more just.
So this is really practical urbanism would focus on neighborhoods and what happens with, say, people building. Would this be like a community garden that then brings people together, a farmer's market that was created by the people within the neighborhood itself? Or
absolutely. Those are two really good examples. And I talk in the book about both community gardening and other sort of elements like that that are at the neighborhood scale. But I think it's important to talk about those examples at the same time as we talk about some of the hardworking people working as public servants in city agencies, oftentimes for decades on particular projects, to try and really bring both the work that public servants are doing, as well as the work that community members are doing, as well as the work that designers and architects are doing to make our neighborhoods a little better.
You know, I don't think we think about this very much because in a city like Chicago, there's so many layers of politicians and deal makers and everything else that city decisions get made and we don't feel like we have much to say in it. I also wonder if we're just in such a transient world these days that especially millennials these days aren't expected to live in a neighborhood for their lives. So how attached somebody gets to a neighborhood, how much effort they're going to put into a neighborhood seems like it would be something much tougher to latch onto or to nurture than it maybe would have been 30 or 40 years ago.
I think that's true. I think we're at a time now where people are expecting to move around a lot in their lifetimes. But we're also seeing a lot of that mobility being something that's bringing a lot of energy to cities and has for over a decade now. Cities are cool, and they have been for quite some time, which they maybe weren't in our parents' generation, where people are moving out to the suburbs. And now we have a tremendous amount of interest in wanting to live in cities and the dynamism that brings, trying to be around people who are different from us. And there's a lot of energy there, but I think we have an opportunity and a responsibility to harness that energy and that interest in wanting to live in dynamic urban environments for the greater good.
Is it so? That's interesting because there is a lot of heat around cities and the cities seem more popular. Now, I imagine 30, 40 years ago, move out to the suburbs, get a big yard, get some room, get to breathe. And now there's kind of maybe all these kids grew up doing that and now they want the feel of the city. So I think I would guess, I have no data here, you would, that millennials are moving into cities after college and that retirees who have money are moving back into cities. So two different groups, but ones who spend a lot of money. And what does that do to people who live in cities by necessity, because that's what they can afford, because it's close to work, because they can take public transportation? Is that screwing up cities at the same time, or does it all depend on how it's handled?
I think one of the greatest opportunities that cities represent today in America, but also around the world, is that they are these great attractors, right? And you definitely have to balance that against the threats of displacement, the threats of gentrification. But I think there are ways to create coalitions. And one of the things I try to sort of lift up and shine a light on in the book is coalitions between newcomers and long-term residents, as well as other kinds of coalitions between designers and artists, between policymakers and people who think about infrastructure or our environment, and really try and harness that energy.
City Makers, the book, is about New York City itself.
That's correct.
And the transformations it's gone over what period of time?
Since 2008, since the financial crash.
Okay. And so it really focuses, like you're saying, on neighborhoods and small things, not top-down city decided certain things like that. Is that where the best things come from? Because when cities make decisions about areas, I'm assuming it's mostly about tax revenue, tax base, people doing this and that. Whereas the stories I'm guessing you're telling are more about people who love their neighborhood, who want to help other people out and build more of a sense of community.
Absolutely. I think that's right. But I think there's a real danger in sort of romanticizing exclusively community-led efforts. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the really sort of grassroots ideas I talk about here. You mentioned community gardens as one, which is one of the first examples I talk about in the book, in a very disinvested part of Brooklyn where I live. And while that is a sort of user-led effort, it wouldn't be possible without strong institutional partners. People buried within city bureaucracy who actually recognize that something good is going on and really try and enable that. And you can do that through a lot of really creative policymaking, whether it's just sort of stepping out of the way and letting communities make decisions for themselves, or through really being a partner through the resources that cities have, whether that's city-owned land that can be turned into from vacant lots into agriculturally productive gardens, or any number of other initiatives where you need a real partnership between the policymakers and the community members.
So since 2008, now New York was already doing pretty well in 2008. When I think of like a New York revitalization thing, I would think of the 70s and 80s, the HBO show The Deuce. Have you seen that at all?
So I saw the pilot.
Is on right now, and that's about the late 70s in New York, and it's very bad in Times Square, things like that. And now it's such a family friendly, and I love going to New York, and it, you know, it's never going to seem clean in New York because it's too big and too old, right? It's just, Chicago had the great fortune to burn down once and get to rebuild, so everything seems a little newer here. And you just have so many people in New York that there's only so much that can be done about that. But New York is really booming and really a great place to go visit. So since 2008, so there was a financial crash. How does that change, or how does that open up this area to start looking at the rebuilding from there? Did that financial crash really affect the neighborhoods of New York?
Absolutely. It did. I mean, you saw there was a when we started Urban Omnibus, which is this online publication on which this book is based. We were at the crest of this, you know, at least 6 years of a huge building boom ever since sort of we started rebuilding after September 11th.
Right.
And you had in the neighborhood where I live, you know, huge high rises going up that were supposed to be luxury condos, and the market crashed and they became, you know, please live here, rent 6 months free.
Yeah.
But even beyond the sort of real estate crisis that created, the crisis that it created for employment, particularly in the design community where a lot of these stories originate, you had a lot of people unemployed. You had a lot of people laid off from their jobs in nice architecture firms. No one was hiring them to make, you know, million-dollar lofts anymore. And so what that unleashed upon the city was a tremendous amount of creative energy for people to pay attention to what was going on in their own backyard. So you do have the community garden stories, but you also have stories of people doing things like setting up pop-up miniature golf courses in their vacant lots as well. I mean, that's sort of a flip example, but it speaks to a deep desire, I think, that people really have, even if they're not in those neighborhoods for generations, right, like you mentioned, to really try and get out there and do something together. I mean, a lot of the stories, the one of the first chapters in the book is about new approaches to public space. And I think that when we're thinking about public space, there's a new desire now, not just to have, you know, beautiful large parks for throwing the ball around or having a picnic with your family, but also for places where you can do things together with strangers, where you can make things. Another fun example in the book is of these underemployed designers who got together to create a series of birdhouses along this toxic canal in Brooklyn, along the Gowanus Canal. And now that, on one hand, is just a nice sort of fun thing for them to do, make something pretty, birds fly by. But it also created this real sort of rallying cry that made it a lot easier to organize volunteers to help clean up this toxic waterway. And I think you see a lot of things like that where you have something that you intend for one particular purpose, and you really have to, it's upon all of us to recognize the ways in which those small scale decisions can layer upon each other to really build something much bigger.
Yeah. when you talk in the book about city makers, is that what you're referring to? People who band together to build things? What's a city maker?
A city maker for me is anyone who sort of dedicates a huge part of their life, whether professionally or in their own volunteer time, to making their neighborhoods a little bit better. But for me, that's not just people who are intervening in public space and doing some physical transformation. It's also the storytellers, you know, the people who are telling stories about our cities, who are interpreting them, whether that's through, you know, art or photography or writing. I mean, I think one of the ways in which we make cities is through the stories that we tell about them, which again contributes to why they become these dynamic places where people want to live. So I think it's both those things. It's telling stories about transformation as well as performing transformation yourself.
You were mentioning that that people want to do things together like this, and it's interesting. I think it's an interesting time because there have been stories out about there's always a lot of stories about millennials these days, right? And there's a story I read recently or within the last year about millennials not being gatherers like our past generations were, like my Generation X, it would be. They're not collecting things. They don't want to buy things and have them. They want to travel. They want to experience things. So maybe they're not going to be looking for the house and the TV and the art or whatever that we end up collecting. They want to see the world and travel and do things. And I wonder if that lends better to practical urbanism, because they'd be more likely to want to get together in the neighborhood and do something together versus a generation that was a little more, we want what we want and we want to have our space and we want to have our yard, and maybe didn't live such a willingness to have an interconnected life.
I think absolutely. I mean, I think there's definitely, you see it all across the different sort of technological platforms that we're using right now. There's a big desire to share more and to own less. And I think I have a chapter in there on technology, and I think one of the big trends that comes out of that is how do we sort of take the good parts of decoupling goods and services, right? We want experiences without having to own something exclusively. We want to be able to share it. And I think there are some real negative aspects of that as well. And I think you see some real sort of challenges with the sharing economy when it comes to job security, for example. I came here in an Uber tonight and was talking to him about how much he actually gets to take home at the end of the day. So I think there are challenges with sharing and with experience, and I think you can't sort of separate the economic argument from all of this. I mean, yes, it's true that millennials are less inclined to own things than maybe their predecessors were, but that's also, I mean, we have 20% or so less than our parents did, in real terms. And so I think there's a real sort of income inequality question there that also feeds into that. So yes, there are desires and demands on the part of young people, but there are also drivers that are really speak to huge economic insecurity that also needs to be addressed.
Well, and the economic insecurity is not just, I think, that you maybe are going to make less. It's just the security of the job itself too, right? Because we talk about how you expect to change jobs 15, 20 times. That's partly because maybe there's a wanderlust among this generation, but a lot of it's also because you don't trust the job is going to be there, right? So you're taking the better job when you can, when you know it's available. I imagine there's, you're not going to have a pension someday. You're not going to get paid by somebody for the rest of your life after you put in your 40 years. That's just not part of it anymore. Tell me a little bit about New York City, because I've visited, but I've grown up here. And here in Chicago, there is definitely two Chicagos. There is the wealthier Michigan Avenue, beautiful touristy Chicago, and there's the Chicago where everybody reads about all the shootings and there's poor and there's everything else. New York has always seemed, I'm sure there's racism in New York and all sorts of problems in New York, but it has always seemed to be such a true melting pot that all of the people mix together. They don't separate into, I'm sure there's separation into boroughs and things like that, but how does New York pull that off? Or am I fantasizing about how much better things are.
I think that's definitely the dream, and that's definitely why I moved to New York and what I love so much about New York, and it still absolutely is there. But I think there, because of the crisis of affordability that I know you're dealing with in Chicago, I was just in LA and San Francisco earlier this week, and they're dealing with it head on as well.
Sure.
You have a lot of that melting pot idea is really, really under threat. And now you have, for the first time ever, new immigrants coming to the city who are going straight to the suburbs, where they are sort of in more sort of ethnically homogenous communities. And I think the promise of the city, which was to be this great equalizer, is very much under threat. New York City does have an unbelievable, dazzling diversity that is incredibly stimulating to me and to most people I know who choose to live there. But it is increasingly seeming like a place for the extremely rich and the extremely poor, and not much time for anyone in between.
Interesting. Well, that's kind of the story of America, isn't it? That we always talk about the middle class is getting squeezed out. So you're either very poor or very rich, and there's not a lot of in between. Kasim Shepherd is in the studio. City Makers, The Culture and Craft of Practical Urbanism is the book. More about that next, 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Kasim Shepherd is with us. City Makers, The Culture and Craft of Practical Urbanism, tells the stories of New York City and the small victories, I guess, is that fair to say, of what's happened in New York, of grassroots efforts to rebuild little areas, little I don't know, little victories of urbanism, of people coming together to help build their city and make better things happen, not just counting on the politicians to spend the money or things like that, right? Is that a fair
description? Yeah, that's right.
Based on a lot of writings from Urban Omnibus, urbanomnibus.net is the website. You can find out more information, but the book should be in bookstores. If not, you can order it online. Kasim would recommend your local bookstore's online selection instead of going to somebody bigger who's, you know, money will not stay within your community. I mean, is that a big part of practical urbanism, is spending dollars within your community?
I think we're seeing across all sectors a desire to sort of connect with the local in different ways. And yeah, that absolutely applies to where you spend your retail dollars, but it also applies to how you spend your time. And like we were talking about a little bit earlier, do you want to go out on a Saturday afternoon and meet up with some friends and strangers and try and build something?
Yeah. You could do that tomorrow or today, actually, at the Stony Island Arts Bank at 2 p.m. on Stony Island Avenue. So I was telling you off the air, I went to Mount Carmel High School, which is just a few 10 or 15 blocks probably away from the Stony Island Arts Bank. And it's been a very rough area for, I mean, I graduated from high school in 1990, and it was a tough area then. It was a tough area in the 70s when there was a lot of gang problems. And it has gone through minor rebirths, never like really, really fully come back. Now the Obama Presidential Center is going to be out there, and we expect great things for the area. What will you be doing at the Stony Island Arts Bank?
Well, tomorrow I'm really excited to meet with local city makers. I'm going to talk a little bit about the book in this really beautiful, incredibly arts-led regeneration strategy that the Rebuild Foundation has done, focused on the Stony Island Arts Bank, but a number of other properties that the Astor Gates and his colleagues have worked on there. But I think what I'm most interested in doing is listening and hearing from people who come out tomorrow about what's happening in Chicago.
What did they do at the Stony Island Arts Bank? What is the regeneration there? It's an old bank. It's an old bank that was closed, I think, forever, right?
For quite some time, yeah.
And now it's an art gallery? It's an art space?
It is a community center. Uh-huh. It is a place that is a public space in the weekends. You can just sort of come in and hang out and see this beautiful... and there's a restoration of the bank, but it's also a place that has assembled a lot of collections of places that were at risk of being lost to history. I forget the name of it, but there was an incredible record store down there that was about to go to a yard sale, and the Rebuild Foundation acquired those records, and now you can go and listen to them. They also have the entire library of Ebony and Jet magazine there, where you can go and sort of a, not a lending library, but you can go and research a lot of the sort of history of black culture in Chicago. But there's a lot of other fun things too. They have DJs on Saturday nights. It's a really sort of exciting art space.
So you and I were talking off the air when I told you that I went to high school down there. I used to work at the Museum of Science and Industry. The Obama Presidential Center is going to come in there, and there's going to be this rebirth of the area, most likely. But the concern is that means more expensive properties, a lot of people get pushed out. How important is it? And there are laws here in Chicago. I know in the reporting I've done for DNA Info, whenever these new properties go up in places, a certain percentage has to be set aside for low income. And if they don't do that within the building, they have to create that low income property elsewhere. And but that's the caveat, is you can, it doesn't have to be within that building. It can be elsewhere, which means that whoever's building in the area of the Obama Presidential Center, if they're not going to build some low-income housing, they can build it elsewhere. And so the low-income just keep getting pushed further and further instead of having a mix, which is, I think, what we would truly like. So we're not always a separated, segregated society. How important is finding a place for affordable housing within cities and within neighborhoods?
Affordable housing is absolutely crucial if we want to maintain the kind of diversity and stimulating aspects of cities that we were talking about earlier. And I mean, the policy wonky description for what you're describing is called inclusionary zoning, where developers are allowed to build a little bit taller than they would be otherwise if they include certain amounts of affordable housing. But that is primarily rental housing, and rental housing is, you know, not as stable as trying to really build equity within communities, because that's the only way you're going to guard against displacement, is if you find structures for people to actually either own their own homes or other kinds of alternative models. I talk in the book about things like community land trusts and limited equity co-ops, other models of ownership that can preserve affordability and create longer term tenure within neighborhoods. Because if you're just building rental housing, it is always going to be subject to those same right. fluctuations of the yeah. market. And so I think we need to think a little bit more expansively about not only how do we provide affordable homes, which might be rental homes or other kinds of homes, but how do we really provide equity, which is something that in this country we've thought of home ownership as being the only way to do that, which also was subsidized in extreme ways, which led to the growth of suburban sprawl.
I was going to say, so you're advocating for something that got us into a lot of trouble, not the way you're advocating for it. Like, you'd like, you know, lower income people to be able to invest in their community and build some equity. But the problem is these lenders that are going to lend to them are going to, you know, it becomes very dangerous, right? I mean, if it's not done correctly, if there isn't a lot of, say, oversight or regulation, and we're not in an area of oversight and regulation right now, at least not for the next 3 years. So there's got to be concern about how you can make that happen and not end up screwing everything up, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting you mention lenders. I mean, I think they're responsible for a lot of the structural disinvestment that we've seen over generations in neighborhoods in the South Side and also in lots of neighborhoods in New York. And you had those same lenders then a generation or two later, instead of sort of redlining and not lending to communities of color, you had them encouraging people to over-leverage their homes in ways that led to the foreclosure crisis, which yeah. is really sort of the starting point for this book, because it was a crisis of foreclosure that in many ways led to the financial crash that is kind of the starting point here. So I think we need to think way beyond traditional financial models, too, as for other forms of building equity,
yeah,
and go beyond sort of the only way to build wealth within communities is for everyone to own their own single family home in the suburbs and then subsidize all of the external costs of driving and the pollution that costs and the highways and all the other things that have led to us kind of overbuilding across large swaths of our country, and really instead try to find ways to invest in the people who are living in communities over long periods of time and really want them to be better and want to stay.
So do you think when there's mandates for a certain amount of affordable housing that some of the mandates should require that it be housing for sale, that it should be condos instead of just rentals?
I don't know. I think condos are tough because I think that's not that different from sort of subsidizing single family homes. I think we need to look beyond sort of the traditional models of everyone having their own individual thing. We were talking about sharing earlier. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of new ways that people want to live together now. If we think about co-housing or we think about other cooperative forms of living that that get beyond the one person, one unit idea.
Well, now it's radical thinking, though, because I can understand that with the way kids are today and they're so used to a sharing economy and they're coming out of school and they're really going to embrace that. But then most of them are going to get married at some point and have kids. And then that's going to be a whole different way of thinking are they going to be willing to be in such a sharing economy when they get to that point in their lives? So I wonder how sustainable that is. You know, if we're not talking, you want them to build equity in this neighborhood, if they don't have an ownership role, whether it's a condo or something that they grasp onto and that really keeps them there, what does keep them there then?
I think it needs to move in even beyond property ownership to be like, what can we do to foster you feeling like you have a stake in this neighborhood and mm-hmm. feel like you actually are being listened to? I think in a lot of the disinvested and poor communities that we think about when we think about places that maybe could use a little bit of regeneration or new ideas or new investment, we often lose sight of just how unlistened to people feel in these neighborhoods because the decisions have been made in city halls or by developers who are outside of these communities.
Yeah.
And I think ways to create methods for people to feel like they have a stake is almost as important as a starting point than getting them to actually own a piece of it themselves.
I would imagine also getting people to want to be involved too, because if, you know, listen, I know in just my everyday life with your kids and whatever else you have going on in your life, you have a lot going on in life. And thinking about how invested you are in your neighborhood is probably pretty far down on the list sometimes. And when you say they don't feel listened to, they don't feel like they have parts of the decisions, I imagine they're not even necessarily thinking about that until somebody asks them. You know, I think a lot of people are just trying to get by day to day to day. And whether they move or not, they might like their neighborhood, might like their neighbors. But we're probably just not as invested as maybe people were in the past, because we're in just such a fast, you know, if you think about the 40s and the 50s, or at least think about what we hear about them, there was just more time your job wasn't 80 hours a week, it was 40 hours a week, whatever it was. And whether you were poor or rich, you just had more time for life, for talking, for getting to know people, for community to come together and help each other out. And that's just not the society we live in right
but
now.
But I think
right?
that the what you're talking about, and I think this also speaks to the, you know, the income challenges that, that we're seeing in the structural changes of our economy, where jobs are less secure, they also require a lot more time. You know, we are creating jobs in this country, but they're not good jobs. They're not the job where you can, you know, support a family on one income with a high school degree. We're expecting more and more and more time and more and more and more and more education, which means more and more debt, yeah. Which does, of course, yes, that becomes a challenge when then we're sort of also asking people to really show up to try and improve their neighborhoods. But I think there's a that's also a driver of this deep desire to connect in different ways with your neighbors and with strangers, and to and I think we see it all across the board, a desire to connect and to really sort of try and push back against those sort of economic forces that are driving us into further and further isolation from our communities. Mm-hmm. People want to connect. They want to be out there with their neighbors.
It's fascinating conversation. City Makers, the culture and craft of practical urbanism. You can go today and hear more from Kasem Shepherd at the Stony Island Arts Bank on Stony Island Avenue at 2:00. Find the book online and in your local bookstore. And his speaking today at Stony Island Arts Bank is part of the Chicago Architecture Biennial. Thanks so much for coming in tonight.
Thanks
really
for having
me. I hope we talk again.